From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. This week, courageous soldiers and controversial preachers in Afghanistan, a peace plan for Syria under increasing threat, and a historic election looms in Egypt. As U.S. and NATO forces begin a gradual drawdown from Afghanistan, the Afghan army is taking a more prominent role in security operations. The soldiers seem to be slowly winning the respect of the Afghan people, but they say they are not getting that same respect from the government they're fighting for. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports from Kabul.
Last month was marked by the Taliban's largest coordinated attack across the country, including three sites inside the capital. It took an 18-hour gunfight to end the assault. But even as they took cover, residents of Kabul saw something new, their own soldiers taking the lead with limited help from NATO. Television footage showed Afghan soldiers moving confidently into the building where militants were holed up, avoiding reckless gunfire that might have endangered civilians in the crowded city.
Let me tell you that if we don't send our sons to be police officers and soldiers, then who should protect our land and our honor? Should we depend on the Americans? No.
One of those feeling new pride in the Afghan forces is Taj Mohammad Jabarkhel, but he does so with a steely sadness. His 28-year-old son Zaman died in the building as part of an Afghan SWAT team. 2 years ago, he lost another son, an army colonel, to a Taliban ambush. That's his six grandchildren you hear running around in the house. If all my boys are killed serving God and country, so be it, says Jabarkhel. He has three more sons in the military. Afghan commanders say stories of valor by their soldiers and police don't always make the papers or win any medals. But there are plenty of stories. Abdul Razak, a 22-year-old police officer, says he joined the force to serve his country, but mostly to support his family with the $240 per month salary. 2 years into his work in Paktika province, he joined Afghan soldiers on a mission to capture a Taliban commander in the town of Yayakhel. The attack ended with Abdul Razak kicking a grenade out of the enemy commander's hand before the man could pull out the pin. Abdul Razak says he threw himself on top of the insurgent and his partner helped cuff him. He did get a commendation for the arrest, but Abdul Razak and his comrades are under no illusions. They say there is little compensation for what they do and plenty of risk. Amanullah Ahmadzai is a 27-year-old Afghan army veteran, also from Paktika. On his very first mission, his convoy hit a roadside bomb. Ahmadzai had one eye to his gun sight. The shrapnel hit his other eye. There was no ambulance with the Afghan convoy. The Americans eventually helped get him to a hospital. But it was Kabul's then-notorious military hospital. In years past, patients there bought their own food or faced starvation. They paid bribes to get medical treatment. The doctors operated on Ahmadzai's eye without anesthetic. He eventually spent twice his military severance pay to get treatment in neighboring Pakistan. But now Ahmadzai says he can't get a job, and his disability pension doesn't always arrive. There are plenty of stories about benefits getting skimmed off by commanders, as well as stories about soldiers having to chip in to buy coffins for their slain comrades, and soldiers stuck on the front line year after year because it takes a bribe to get them sent to a safer place. And there are stories of Afghan soldiers killed in action whose children end up begging in the street. I don't want anything special from the government, says Ahmadzai. All I want is some respect for disabled veterans like me. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Kabul.
The Afghan ministry that governs religious affairs has announced what some are calling a three-strikes policy for preachers accused of inciting violence in their Friday sermons. This is an attempt to rein in imams, as they're called, who routinely condemn the U.S. presence in Afghanistan or speak in favor of the Taliban. The United States is also working to convince Afghanistan's Muslim clerics to moderate their messages, and recently a White House envoy made a visit deep into Taliban territory. Here again is NPR's Quill Lawrence in Kabul.
Despite the rapid growth of the media in Afghanistan, many still get their news and commentary on Friday at the mosque. The Friday sermon usually has one religious lesson, but another section reserved for current events. The message on one recent Friday at a central Kabul mosque was about corruption. The imam railed against corrupt politicians, but it was tame compared to what often comes over the loudspeakers. In rural areas, the sermons sometimes directly support the Taliban. Regular rants against the government and its American allies prompted the Ministry of Religious Affairs to put mosques nationwide on notice. Abdul Malik Zayi, a senior ministry official, says imams, many of whom are appointed by the ministry, will get three strikes if they incite violence. First a warning, then a dismissal from the post, and then, if they keep preaching, a visit from Afghanistan's security services. The Minister of Religious Affairs later said the policy was not so clear-cut, but imams around Kabul are already talking about it. Only a fraction of the 100,000 mosques in Afghanistan are officially registered, so the impact of the new rule is questionable. But it demonstrates the level of concern, which is shared by the White House.
If Islam is being taught in the proper way, and people are studying the Quran and reading it, it's very obvious that the religion rejects terrorism.
Rashad Hussein is the Obama administration's special envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. He was in rural Paktika province last month as part of a tour of Afghanistan. Hussein is a religious scholar and surprised a group of local mullahs by reciting verses of the Quran for memory. The mullahs in the meeting said they agreed with Hussein completely and thanked him politely for coming. But Hussein says he knows there are many in Afghanistan who get a different message at the mosque, and the vast majority of them are illiterate.
There's some places where people don't understand the Quran, they're not able to read, and those people are exploited. And oftentimes what's taught to them is taught to them in the name of religion, even though the religion itself rejects the idea that you can kill innocent people to achieve your objective.
A string of provocative incidents this year has made it hard for imams to keep silent. The errant burning of Qurans on a U.S. base, as well as the massacre of civilians by a U.S. soldier in Kandahar. Ahmed Shah Ahmadzai, a former prime minister of Afghanistan, says it's impossible to stop preachers from speaking out.
Your soldiers are killing. Your soldiers are doing very, very bad things there. They are stepping here on Quran. Don't torture Muslims in Afghanistan. Don't kill innocent children, women, and girls.
The United Nations and the Afghan government blame the large majority of civilian deaths on the insurgents, but mullahs rarely denounce the Taliban, perhaps out of fear. This week did see a string of civilian casualties from NATO airstrikes, a topic that will surely get attention at this Friday's sermons across the country. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Kabul.
Coming up, Egypt gets ready for a historic presidential election. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. In Egypt this past week, two of the leading contenders in the upcoming presidential election squared off in the Arab world's first ever televised presidential debate. The marathon 4.5-hour session touched on many topics important to Egyptians who vote later this month for their first democratically elected president. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson in Cairo reports that many Egyptians found the debate riveting.
Waiters and patrons thronged the plasma screen TVs at Gol Cafe in the trendy Zamalek neighborhood as the debate began a half hour late. Some, like 18-year-old high school student Ahmed Hamouda, were suspicious about this latest democratic milestone in their country. He complains that the candidates can say anything they like, but adds that it's more important for Egypt's next president to be judged by what he does. Nevertheless, they were glued to the screens as former Brotherhood leader Abdelmonem Aboulfatoua and former Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa sparred with each other. Political science professor Hassan Nafa is a columnist for the Egyptian daily Al-Masriyoum. He says the interest is understandable, given Egyptians for the first time have a say in who their next leader will be.
Egypt has never been so politically motivated, so instead of watching TV series, they are watching political debate every night.
The two private Egyptian stations hosting the debate made sure the broadcast included plenty of dramatic flair. Moderators and analysts spent hours beforehand explaining the Western-style format to viewers.
Mr. Nixon comes out of the Republican Party.
They showed excerpts of the 1960 debate between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon.
Mr. Nixon, would you like to comment on that statement?
I have no comment.
Afterward, analysts discussed the two American men's styles.
Would you like to respond to Senator Biden's comments about John McCain?
No, thank you.
The experts also discussed the 2008 debate between vice presidential candidates Sarah Palin and Joe Biden, while featuring a Saturday Night Live parody of the debate with Tina Fey playing the role of Palin.
Hockey moms and Joe six-packs.
The Egyptian candidates were asked 24 questions by two moderators. They were also allowed to pose questions to each other. But the men were restricted to a two-minute time limit per answer, a rarity in this Egyptian campaign season where politicians often drone on. While the candidates were civil in tone, their words for each other were often harsh. Each criticized the other's reaction to the recent clashes between soldiers and protesters in front of the defense ministry. Moussa repeatedly dismissed Aboulfatoua as a radical Islamist. The former Brotherhood leader, in turn, denounced Moussa as an unwelcome remnant of the Mubarak era. Back at the Gol Cafe, architect Amr Sobhi wasn't impressed.
Right now, they're both are losing for me. The debate is not very good, but I'm pro Aboulfatoua, so right now I'm rooting for him, but I'm not finding what I'm looking for.
But Sobhi says he's glad Egyptians were getting a chance to see a presidential debate. He adds it's a good way for voters to test the candidate's mettle. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
As the Egyptian vote nears, campaign billboards line the highways. Candidates are on the stump and making the rounds of the political talk shows. Kimberly Adams in Cairo reports that many Egyptian families are hosting their own forums for debate.
The normally slow traffic in Cairo becomes even more jammed up than usual on Friday and Saturday nights as Cairenes pack into their cars to go on family visits. It's common here for people to meet with their extended families on a weekly or bi-weekly basis, usually at the home of an older relative. In the upper middle class neighborhood of Heliopolis, a collection of aunts, uncles, and cousins meets in the fashionably decorated living room of 79-year-old Zaina Hamza. Before last year's revolution, she says these family gatherings were just a chance to catch up.
Talk about everything. About expensive food, whatever you think about, anything.
But since then, the conversation has changed. Her granddaughter, Nohan Osama, is 20 and studies law and English.
The conversation were completely different about now. We never talked about politics. Never, ever. Yes, never, ever about anything. We weren't interested.
There's no doubt they are interested now. Political sociologist Saeed Sadek, who teaches at the American University in Cairo, says these family get-togethers have been a key outlet for political debate in the 15 months since the ouster of President Hosni Mubarak.
In Egyptian families who were not usually interested in politics and they were only interested in daily events and entertainment and things like that, politics became very important because it began to affect their lives, and now they began to feel that politics are important.
Sadek says the family meetings often reveal the gap in opinion between younger and older generations. That gap exists in Hamza's family. Her granddaughter, Sally, won't support any candidate with ties to the former regime. But Sally's mother supports Mubarak's one-time foreign minister, Amr Musa, who is among the frontrunners. But in this upper-middle-class family, there is some common ground.
Sally, but at least all of us agree on one thing, that none of us are voting for the Islamists.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. And I'm veiled, by the way, so no.
But some 15 miles outside Cairo, in the economically distressed village of Sakhil, posters for Islamist candidates on the sides of dilapidated apartment buildings showed the community support for more conservative leadership. To get to the home of Hayat Ahmed Dawood, you have to step around huge holes in the dirt road. Men are using cell phones for light as they dig the village's first sewer system. Inside Dawood's home, she and her sister Hekma, both in their 70s, preside over their meeting of adult children, in-laws, and small grandchildren. Many in this family support the Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi because they want a president who plans to bring Islamic values to the job. But others in the Dawood family want a more secular candidate. Their support for Amr Musa here, as well as former Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq. Even though the debate can get a bit heated at times, Hekma Dawood enjoys the exchange of ideas.
Before, people could not talk, but now everyone has an opinion and has freedom. It is very good. The country is better than before.
Political sociologist Sadek says the revolution has put Egypt through a crash course in political participation.
And in the last 1 year and a half during this transition, the Egyptians are learning everything that they didn't know about politics, from how to write constitution, what is a constituent assembly, what is a free election, fair election, all these things that did not exist.
The Hamza and Dawood families may not agree on which candidate to support, but they do agree on one thing. They're all planning to vote. For NPR News, I'm Kimberly Adams in Cairo.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.